This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue in the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a paleontologist from Cape Breton has made a one-of-a-kind discovery dating back almost 300 million years. On The Good Sentence, we take a walk down memory lane all the way to Gabarouse, and we'll hear about a nail-biter at City Hall, a close vote requiring the mayor to weigh in with the tie-breaking vote. These stories are coming up on the Coast 89.7. A heated discussion followed by a down-the-middle vote marked the restart of the CBRM's negotiations with a group looking to break ground at Sidport. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Postlewaite reports.
Mayor Cecil Clark cast the deciding vote to restart negotiations with the Sydney Harbour Investment Partners, known as SHIP, to develop the Greenfield site in Sidport. For over 10 years, SHIP had the exclusive right to market and develop the Greenfield site. The group had first looked to develop a container terminal. However, a lack of rail access left the project in limbo until the group pivoted to developing it into an offshore wind marshalling site. In January, the CBRM Council voted to end negotiations with SHIP on the site and revoke their exclusive contract in favor of hiring a consultant to assess more proposals for the Greenfield site. However, 8 months later, CBRM District 7 Councillor Steve Parsons says there's been no other interest in the site and put a motion forward to restart negotiations with SHIP. At August's regular council meeting, he explained why he was putting the motion forward now.
This request is being submitted as new business because of substantive changes and materially different circumstances, including the following. Given that the timing for Nova Scotia's offshore wind licensing process has been set for the fourth quarter of 2026, CBRM Council needs to position itself with a developer that is ready and able to begin construction. SHIP is presently the only developer in a position to deliver on this scope of work, as the province of Nova Scotia, through its Department of Energy, has identified Sydney's Greenfield site as a potential laydown area to support its offshore wind strategy. CBRM can enter into new negotiations with SHIP and be positioned to work with both the provincial and federal governments to establish the infrastructure needed to support this industry. Given the specific requirements associated with this infrastructure, including permitting, financing, capacity, and an Indigenous partners, SHIP is currently in the best position to deliver the scope of work.
He encouraged other councillors to make their decisions based on the merits of the project. However, many councillors pushed back on restarting negotiations. District 2 Councillor Earlene McMullen argued that during her time on council, she has seen little to no movement at the site.
And we talk a lot about optics. How does it look? What the world's looking at us. We're making an example. We're passing time. We're missing opportunity. Well, what's the optics of CBRM, who obviously has a little bit of attention on what could potentially happen here, whether it's port, whether it's wind, whatever it is, when we pass a motion of council before we get the proper guidance of the people in the know, the world leaders of the industry to guide us? What are the optics when we decide to pick one entity and say, let's negotiate with them by ourselves? Optics work both ways. So if there is somebody else out there, even though we're being told by individuals around this table there's absolutely no one, but just if there is, how welcome would they be knowing that we've already just said, you know what, we know more than this guy coming in, we'll get started with you guys and see what happens. To me, that does not look professional.
District 9 Councillor Dave McKeegan also spoke against the motion, saying they need to open the process up and that SHIP will have opportunities to meet with consultants. District 3 Councillor Esmond Blue Marshall spoke passionately in defense of the deal with SHIP, saying it was made in partnership with the CBRM's Indigenous communities.
How can we move if you don't help us with First Nations to help you guys? We want our people back to work here. I said that a long time ago when we had this thing going on, container ship. We want our people back home, have more taxes for us, but we're just stalling. How can you get our younger people back home? And that's what I said all the time. Why can we can't do this properly? We're doing it. Just don't hold back and let's just move on. And I see it and I hear it. I left for a while, came back. We're still here. Let's move on now. Let's work together and work with us as a First Nation people. Work with us. Seems like you don't want to work with us. That's what I feel. That's what I feel. That's what I feel here. You don't want to work with us. And it's hurting. Thank you.
Marshall's comments ended the discussion on the motion. The vote to restart negotiations with SHIP was split 6-6 between the councillors. Councillors Marshall, Parsons, Steve Gillespie, Eldon McDonald, Paul Nicotuck, and Darren O'Quinn voted in favor of the motion, while councillors McMullen, McKeegan, Gordon McDonald, Glenn Perouche, Stephen McNeil, and Kim Shepherd-Campbell voted against the motion. The tie was broken by CBRM Mayor Cecil Clark, who voted in favor of restarting negotiations. After the meeting, he explained why he chose to support them.
I believe it's important to continue on a path when we have known entities that have put forward a very clear plan for our community and have worked within the regulatory framework of the federal and provincial offshore regulator, but also have invested millions of dollars in the process over the last 12, 13 years when we were in a situation where the municipality was paying for people to be investing and supporting development for the community. So it's important to continue forward. The clock is ticking. The province has indicated that very clearly, and we don't want to lose out on opportunity needlessly.
Councillor Parsons further explained why he supports restarting negotiations with SHIP.
This is not a bit of exclusivity. It's getting back to the table to negotiate a company that's ready, pre-qualified to bid an project on the offshore Nova Scotia. The regulator is putting out the request for proposals as far as licensing on what companies will bid what lots and what projects. If we don't, in my opinion, have time to go out to start over with potentially working with 11 other developers coming back with a deal after talking to 11. Can you imagine the timing that it would take to negotiate with 11, even if 11 were interested? Nobody has come to our table since January. When we broke off, you heard it today, we stopped negotiations with SHIP. I haven't seen anybody come to our door knocking from the other 11 that got pre-qualified in terms of what they can do working with CBRM. Not one. And if somebody can show me that somebody came here, then great.
District 12 Councillor Kim Shepherd-Campbell explained why she chose to vote against the motion.
So my concerns are that we're telling people who are out there who may come forward who want to do development here that we're only looking at working with one company. I still want a fair process like council voted for before. We get the consultant, we go out looking to see who's there, bring it back and vote on it that way.
It's unclear when exactly those negotiations will resume. It's expected the chief administrative officer and the CBRM's legal counsel will be participating in the negotiations. This has been coverage of the Cape Breton Regional Municipality Council's decision to restart negotiations with the Sydney Harbour Investment Partners on the Greenfield site in Sidport.
Dr. Mark McDougall, originally from Sydney Mines, now working as a professor in Manitoba, is a paleontologist who's uncovered some very interesting finds, one of them dating back 290 million years ago. He talks to Dialogue's Cora Perigo.
Specifically, I study early tetrapods. So these are reptiles and amphibians and things like that, mammal ancestors from around 300 to 290 million years ago. So this is well before the dinosaurs were even on the scene at this point.
And you're originally from Cape Breton?
Yeah, I'm originally from Sydney Mines.
Kind of the big thing that you've been getting a lot of press for is the world's oldest vomit so far.
Yeah, so the oldest vomit, that was from before coming back to Canada. I was in Germany at the Natural History Museum in Berlin for just about almost 7 years of, and I was working at a lot of German sites over there, in particular one in central Germany. And I was part of a team that discovered that site where that discovered that fossil vomit. So that was, we just published that this year, and yeah, it got a lot of press. Obviously, it's kind of a cool story there. So it would be the oldest example of vomit, of an animal vomiting on land that we currently know of. So it was one of these, probably an apex predator, so top of the food chain from this site that we're studying in central Germany.
What was it like to discover this?
So these are always, with fossils, often in the field, you don't realize what you have right away, because you will find like a little bit of bone sticking out from like a rock, and you're like, okay, there's something here. And we don't know exactly what yet. Then that will usually go back to the museum. We have technicians that will prepare it. They remove the rock from around the bone. And then you start to get an idea of what you might have. And here in this case, it was very bizarre. Just the orientation of the bones and the fact that we were getting multiple, what appeared to be different types of bones from different, potentially different species kind of clumped together. As well, it was a very odd looking, it's not typically what you would expect for just a random array of bones. So that got us thinking about this a bit more. We did chemical analysis to kind of compare it to other types of fossils like this, like coprolites, which are fossil poop. So we wanted to make sure we weren't looking at something like that. And instead we were actually probably looking at fossil vomit. We looked at the orientation of the bones. So they tended to be all aligned in the same direction, which suggests that once these animals were being digested in the stomach, because the stomach is only so wide, the bones would all get lined up in a similar kind of pattern. And then, of course, we also use CT scanning. This is like when you go to the hospital and you get a CAT scan, it's very similar. So it's like multiple x-rays through these fossils that allows us to reconstruct them in 3D. So we can use software to reconstruct all the bones that we found in this vomit. And that was where I kind of came in, and I went through, because my expertise is in all these early tetrapods, and I went through and identified at least as much as I could what potential animals were in here. And we identified at least three different animals that we knew were from this site in central Germany that were in this vomit. So this animal, this apex predator, had been munching on many different things from this site. And then at some point, it got an upset stomach. Bones are obviously very hard to digest, so it's likely that after the tissue and stuff was digested, it just vomited up all these remaining bones. And then they happen to become preserved, and we find them almost 290 million years later.
In kind of conjunction with kind of the novelty of, you know, oh, this is like the oldest vomit that we've ever found. And what does, I guess, that tell us now? Like, what is the, I guess, the importance of looking at these kinds of fossils today?
So this is important because this is direct evidence what the food chain at this ancient ecosystem would have been like. So ecosystems back 290 million years ago, this is in this time period that I'm looking at, that we were looking at this site, generally they're very different from what we see today, because a lot of these animals had only recently, I say recently in geological time, so but in millions of years, but they had only recently come up onto the land and were starting to make terrestrial ecosystems. These are everywhere today on Earth, but at this point they were relatively novel. So this is telling us a lot about the food chain and the ecosystem that would have been present here. We have direct evidence that a larger animal, and there's only a few candidates from the site that this could potentially be, that would be big enough to eat these animals, was actually eating these three animals here. So we're getting direct evidence of kind of like the food web that would have been present here. So this is really important for reconstructing ecology. It also gives us evidence of behavior, which is very rare to find from fossils, because when you look at a fossil, like if you find like a fossil dinosaur, it's really cool. You can get a lot from it, but interpreting things like behavior are very difficult unless you get things like this. Like if we know that this animal ate these animals and then at some point threw up their remains.
And I know you said there's a few candidates it could be. Are you able to share the possible?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So At this site in central Germany, there are only a few larger animals. They belong to a group called the synapsids. This is the group that would eventually become mammals. So we are synapsids. We are modern examples of them. But there is two candidates. One would be, it's called Tambacarnifex. It would have been a large predatory synapsid that would have been there. And another one is Dimetrodon. And people may be more familiar with this one. It's a bit prominent in like pop culture and stuff like that, often mistaken as a dinosaur. It's this large synapsid that has this big sail on its back. It's often, you'll see it if you go to museums and things like that. So it's very famous as far as animals of this age go. So that is present there as well. And it would have been the top predator at this site. So it's a very good candidate for the animal that may have been eating these other animals.
And you were just recently back in Cape Breton with the Fossil Center. Can you speak about the work that you were doing there?
Yeah. So now that I'm back in Canada, I'm very interested in studying, and I've done a bit of this in the past as well during my PhD, but studying early tetrapods from Fossil Canada. And the East Coast, Atlantic Canada, is the best place to do that. So we have from places like Joggins on the mainland of Nova Scotia, the oldest representatives of both reptiles as well as synapsids, that group that we belong to, that becomes mammals, they are from Nova Scotia. So this is one of the best places in the world to study these groups and their origins and their evolution. And Cape Breton has also in the past produced a lot of very interesting and important fossils from these groups around similar age, not quite as old as Joggins, but pretty close. So I'm very interested and have been interested in the last few years, have been going in here and identifying sites of interest that we, in association with Jason Loxton from the Cape Breton Fossil Center, I've been going in there. We've been looking at these sites and trying to identify sites that would be have the potential for potential fossil finds that we want to keep monitoring and going back to in the future and potentially do some excavations and things like that. So this year was a lot of reconnaissance going out to some sites that were difficult to access. We did think we used like a with Dr. Bruce Hatcher, an aquatic ecologist at CBU. He took us out in his Zodiac around to some difficult to access sites and things like that. So it was actually a very productive fieldwork season for looking at some of these potential sites. And we have now identified some sites that we want to continuously monitor and go back to and hopefully potentially find some fossils at them in the future of some of these early tetrapods.
Kind of with the looking for these tetrapods, and obviously you don't know what you're going to find when you go out there. And, you know, it's not like you have like a shopping list of these are the things we're hoping to find. You know, it's hoping to hopefully find new discoveries or things that'll teach us about our past and kind of who we are now. But is there anything you're kind of not quite expecting to find, but maybe hoping to find in relation to these tetrapods or anything that you're kind of looking for in a way?
Yeah, so one of the big things is if you walk around some of the beaches in Cape Breton and on the mainland, such as Joggins, you'll see these ancient fossil trees that are often preserved. And you often might sometimes see the stumps of them and things like that. There's many areas on the island like Florence and Sydney Mines and places like that, as well as some of the other sites that we're looking at that you can find these. And these stumps would often have become hollowed out 300 million years ago due to things like forest fires and things like that. And once they were hollowed out, they would be refuges for smaller animals, small reptiles, amphibians, things like that. So they would make their nests and live in these trees. And then during certain kind of more dramatic events like mudslides and things like that, or being covered over in various ways, they would be trapped in these trees and then preserved. So we often find, in many cases, early tetrapod remains within these tree stumps. So that is something that we've been very interested in keeping our eye out for, identifying areas where we may have lots of these stumps that could, and monitoring them. Because sometimes they're up in the cliff, but every season, like every year, storms, the winter, things like that, more and more of these will fall out of the cliffs. So it's important to continually monitor these areas because there is a high potential to find early tetrapods at these kinds of sites with these fossil trees. So we're very interested in that. And a really important part of this is kind of continually monitoring these areas, which is why it's very important, I think, that the general public is aware of this. Because as paleontologists, we can only be out on the beach. We're only a few of us, and we can only monitor them so much. So it's really important when people are out walking along beaches in Cape Breton and Nova Scotia and the Maritimes in general in certain areas, that they keep their eyes out because many of the most important fossils from these areas have just been found by regular people walking on the beaches in like Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island and things like that. And if they hadn't have been there, those fossils would have probably been lost just due to erosion and getting washed away by storms and the tides and things like that. So I think it's very critical. I think like citizen science is extremely important for the kind of research that we're trying to do. And if people do identify or find something that they think is a fossil, contact one of us, contact a paleontologist, contact the Fossil Center, the Nova Scotia Museum, things like that. And then a professional can get out there and hopefully retrieve that fossil.
Kind of starting in Cape Breton and kind of talking about kind of citizen science, what really got you into fossils? Did you stumble across something, or was it just like this lifelong interest?
So I have pretty much had a lifelong interest from very young age, but part of that was stemmed from the beaches here in Cape Breton, because you walk up the beach and a lot of these you will find plant fossils. I'm not a paleobotanist. That's not what I focus on. But it is very cool, and it sparked my interest in a lot of this. So as I started going through my academic career, I started interested in dinosaurs, as I think most young people do. When I was young, Jurassic Park had just come out and things like that. So there was a lot of things that kind of drove my interest in that. But as I started doing my academic education through undergrad and my PhD, I gained appreciation for all of the fossil groups outside of dinosaurs, because there is a lot of really interesting animals out there. And dinosaurs are very cool, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of other very cool fossil groups as well. And the early tetrapods, personally, I find extremely interesting, which is why I'm so interested in doing fieldwork here in Nova Scotia and Cape Breton.
And we kind of spoke specifically about, you know, what we can glean from like the vomit fossil, but just any kind of fossil, what do you think is the continued importance of examining these? Because I think some people are like, oh, it's just like a cool thing from the past. But I think a lot of people are like, well, how does this affect us now? What do we learn that it like influences us now, or how we can learn about ourselves in 2026?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So fossils, for the one thing they inform us of is our evolutionary history. Like I said, the earliest examples of us synapsids are from these sites here in Nova Scotia. So our early ancestors were around 300 million years ago, crawling around at these sites, which I think personally is very cool when you think about it like that. It also is really important, like I said, some of these fossils, like especially ones like vomit and trackways, like footprints are very common from many sites in Nova Scotia as well. They inform us aspects of behavior and how these animals lived, how these ecosystems were coming together. So we get a better idea for the ecosystems that would have been present back then. And that's really important for understanding how the ecosystems we have today on Earth, how those ecosystems came to be, because all of the representatives that we have today, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, fish, everything, they were also present back here 300 million years ago as well. They were just a lot more recent and coming up onto land. So it informs us a lot of things like how climate changes, how these ecosystems change, the behaviors of these groups. So there is a lot of important things we can glean from fossils. It's not just this was a cool animal that was present here. There is a lot more that we can interpret from these.
What would you say to like a young, maybe aspiring paleontologist in Cape Breton about looking for fossils, about, you know, getting into this kind of field?
So first of all, I would definitely encourage you to like young people to go check out the museums that we have. We have the Nova Scotia, the Natural History Museum in Halifax, very nice museum. We have the Cape Breton Fossil Center in Sydney Mines, which not a lot of people unfortunately know about, I find, when I talk to people about this. Not a lot of people realize it's there. It's very good. Jason's done a great job with it in the last few years. I would highly recommend people take a look. They do great tours, things like that. The other thing is to talk to paleontologists. I am always happy to talk to young aspiring students or children about this stuff. Like, so feel free to email parents that have kids that are interested in this. Email a paleontologist, where I'm often always happy to talk to people. I love getting emails like that, or talking to people who have an interest in this. So that's something you should do. And most paleontologists are happy to talk to people about that kind of stuff. The other thing is when you pursue this, look for if people are serious about pursuing this further on, is to start doing this during undergrad and start interacting with paleontologists. You can volunteer like for digs potentially. We had a few volunteers come out with us that were interested for some of our field work, things like that. So that's, once again, if you start talking to paleontologists, you'll get opportunities for stuff like that. So I think it's really important to just make those kind of connections and talk to some of those people. And they will also help you, you know, give guidance for where you should go if you want to do a career in something like this.
And a couple weeks ago, I spoke to Dr. Dan Snyder when he was in Nova Scotia and Jason Loxton. Why do you think Nova Scotia is like this hub for all these like super interesting, important fossils?
So yeah, this is something that people don't realize. Nova Scotia has always been a site of interest for hundreds of years ago. Scientists were coming over from London and things like that. Many of our most important fossils are actually in London, at the Natural History Museum there, because they were coming over and they identified that this was a very important site of interest. So here in Nova Scotia, our rocks, the rocks that we have are of such an age in most places, especially in Cape Breton, that they are preserving these really old 300 million year old ecosystems. You don't get that other places in Canada necessarily, because like places like Alberta, you're more likely to get much younger rocks with the dinosaurs. But here in Eastern Canada, they are preserving the rocks of the right age that are thankfully preserving these fossils as well. So it just happened. A lot of it is just, you know, luck of the draw, what rocks you have in a certain area. We can't always choose that. But in Nova Scotia, we have the right age for a lot of these really important time periods.
And is there anywhere that people can kind of keep up to date with the things that you're working on?
Yeah, so I'm pretty active. I'm not so active online, but I should be more active online. But you can contact, you can follow me. My profile and stuff like that are on the Brandon University website. I often do little guest talks. Like I gave a talk back at the Fossil Center last week, and I'll be giving a talk in Brandon in a few months as well. But for the most part, yeah, you can follow me on my profiles on social media and the Brandon University website.
That was Dr. Mark McDougall, originally of Sydney Mines, on his career in paleontology.
On The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks to Bill McLean, originally from Gabarus and now living back there after 45 years working in Montreal, about his new photo book, Gabarus Cape Breton, a photo album.
So, Bill, before we get into the book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I grew up in Gabarus Lake. I was born in 1953. Went to the local school. It was a one-room schoolhouse. My mother was a teacher, so went there from primary to grade 8, and then on to Marion Bridge and Riverview. Then graduated from Riverview, and then first year of university was at, we used to call it Xavier College back in the day, and then 3 years at St. Yvette's, and then I graduated in 1975 with Bachelor of Science in Geology, and then took a year off, went to Europe, as people did back in those days with a backpack, and didn't decide what I wanted to do, so I took a BED at Acadia, and then got a teaching job in Quebec. This would be in the fall of 77, I guess. And stayed 2 years there at a place called Port Cartier on the north shore of Quebec. Didn't like teaching, and then moved to Montreal to study photography. Graduated from the Dawson Institute of Photography, which is a college in Montreal. And then freelanced for a while, but that was a tough way to make a living, so I did various things. And then ended up working for myself in the cleaning business, doing offices, commercial spaces around the city, and lived in Montreal for almost 45 years, and retired at 71, which was later than I expected. But and then I've been here. I've been here in Cape Breton 2 years. I'm living in Gabrus at where the house of my mother grew up. It took a lot of renovations, but I did quite a bit of work on it over the years. So.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing. But obviously, photography is your passion. And this book that came out just a couple of months ago, Gabrus, Cape Breton, a photo album, is, I'll tell our Coast listeners, this is a really beautiful book. They're all black and white pictures from days gone by. But it's more than just a photograph. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how you came to do the book and what the book is about, and then we'll talk a bit about some of the really interesting things in it.
Okay, well, the initial idea was to have only photographs, because I'm not a writer, and I thought that would be the simplest way to go. So I started in the spring, probably May of 2019. My brother picked me up in the airport. I flew in from Montreal. I had my scanner with me, and we headed out to Catalan. A gentleman named Buddy McDonald, who at one time ran a service station near Albert Bridge, but he grew up in Gabrus Lake. So that session went well. Got quite a few photographs, and then, of course, when I got back, COVID hit, so it changed everything, and I couldn't travel. I couldn't get down. So I decided to call people up on the phone and just talk about old times. And one of the problems was I all the years I was in Montreal, I would visit in the summers for like a week, 10 days, but you lose track of people, right? So it took me a while to figure out who lived in Gabrus and who I could contact. So all in all, I think I have about 30 individual contributors, and plus some archives. And then it just kind of evolved from there. I was very lucky through mutual friends to meet Catherine, who designed the book. So she did a great job putting all the pieces together. So
that's Catherine Demert?
That's right. Yes. She's in Dartmouth. So we worked together to put the get the final product ready.
It's beautifully laid out. And I was really taken with all those numerous fascinating diary entries. So before we get into a little bit about that, do you think people still keep diaries and the details they put in them today, like the things that you found and that you have that accompany some of your photos from the 20s and 30s and the 40s? Is it the same, or is that died out, or what? What do you
think?
Are
you referring to the Lewisburg diaries?
Yeah, and the Huntington diaries and all those
things. Yes. I don't know. I mean, I spent about 7 or 8 hours going through the whole thing. I mean, some of it is quite tedious. Like he would say, well, you know, wind is from the northwest today. We got 2 inches of snow. But if you keep at it, you'll find some interesting things. I guess there is some, well, perhaps we call it something called journaling today.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Perhaps going in more into personal matters rather than just recording the weather and so forth. I don't really know. I guess at one time I did keep a diary, but it didn't last for very long. My father did that, but on a, I mean, if you go, we had a burn, and he would like write it's like March 5th, 1957, cutting props, very cold, you know, a foot of snow, something like that, you know, or he would write that under a chair.
Yeah.
And when I go to my grandfather, I'm living in my grandfather's house, you know, I take a look at the bottom of the chair when I'm washing the floor, and there's his signature with the date, you know. So perhaps it had something to do with that time, I don't know.
There's an interesting one here from from a Stella Mann. I'm just going to read this for our listeners.
Okay.
And honest to God, I find tedious is not the word. I find this stuff really super fascinating. So she says, this is written somewhere between 1900 and 1920. I remember with a photo of the Gull Cove Post Office, home of Charles Hardy. She says, I remember seeing Mrs. Hardy sitting in a rocking chair near the small compartments in the kitchen when I called for the mail for my aunt's family. The Hardy family had an organ in their parlor. On one of my brief visits, I was asked to play a piece on the organ, and I thought this was quite an honor. So I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, well, there's the post office, and the post office has an organ, and the people, and she's going there probably as a young kid or whatever, and they're asking her to play, and it seems to tell so much about the time in those pictures and those reminiscences that might seem fairly simple, but now we know the post office had an organ, right?
And you can That's go right. Well, there were other entries in the diaries about people in Gabrus buying organs, so it must just seem to be like a status symbol. I don't know.
But they could be bought. Like some are maybe they're coming from Sydney, or they're being brought in from Halifax. You know, whatever. And then people learning to play them. That right?
That's right.
Yeah. I really want to read this one. Charles Clark, in conversation with Nelson McCormick, and he says, this is from the Beaton Institute at CBU, you found this, you can't take a farmer and make a fisherman out of him. You can't take a stranger and put him in Gabarus Bay. When you're born here, you know every rock, every point, every tree along the shore when you're there for 50 years. You want to just elaborate a bit on that, because I just find that brilliant, right?
Well, I think people grew up and lived in their villages, right? So this gentleman, I didn't know him, but he probably started fishing with his father, and then just went on from there. So you were even myself growing up, you were very attached to your surroundings. I used to hunt quite a bit when I was a kid, so you knew all the wood roads, and I'd love to explore. You might hit a road, and where's it going? You hit a brook. Well, where does the brook end up? Or you'd hit a crown line, and then I'd have maps, looking at the map. So I was like a little Cape Breton voyageur, you know.
Yeah.
So and it was like that for most people. They were very attached to the land, or they knew the new prominent land places on the beach or points on the lake where you'd go. So. I think it was just part of the culture, and of course, fishing. I mean, it's a bit more serious because you have to know where the shoals are and where not to go, and weather conditions and so forth. So, I think it was just something that was passed on. And of course, a farmer would be. I guess you could learn to fish, but it was mainly like my grandfather. Both my grandfathers never fished. One was a blacksmith, the other was a farmer, and had his own sawmill. You know, so.
Yeah, there was the book is full of numerous pictures that revolve around being out on the water and fishing, and there's fantastic one of swordfish being caught, and then the lobster factory. Here's a guy, Horace Gray says, it was like a great big barn inside. The lobsters were partially cooked in the shell. The men chopped them open, and the women removed the meat. The meat was then canned and placed in a large open pot to complete the cooking. All the machinery was run by steam. I mean, that tells you a lot, like in a couple of sentences, plus the wonderful picture.
It does, yeah. I was hoping to get a photograph of the interior, but unfortunately I didn't find one. I mean, there's one thing about the project is there's a lot of rabbit holes you could go down, right? I mean, did the company owning the lobster factory, did they have financial records? Is it recorded somewhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of left it at that because, yeah, I agree. I think he had a pretty good description right there.
Yeah, and like what time period did that lobster factory run? Like I have no recollection of that out there.
Yeah, I don't know when it started. I think it probably shut down sometime in the late 30s or the 40s. The building was still there when I was a kid, but I never went inside it. But Yeah, I think then it changed ownership several times, but there's still, you can still get the wrappers from the cans. I think there's someone at home here, but Gabri's Lobster, it's quite colorful, you know, so
yeah,
like the logo, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a really neat picture of lobster workers. It's credited to a Blanche Kahn, and there's got to be 30 people in it, or maybe 40, and men and women. And the quote from this Earl McVicker: I remember going down there with my father. We'd load the lobster bodies on the truck wagon and bring them home for fertilizer, spread them on the ground and plow them in. So, you know, nothing was wasted. But, I mean, this was a, you know, you, this many people, those are in the photo. Some might have been even missing, right? That was a big operation.
Yeah, it was quite an employer for local people, yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
And you had other people, I think some of the management would come in from elsewhere in the province, and there was, they called it the Stacy Hotel. It's still around today. I think they would stay there, you know, while they were at Gabri's.
Yeah, there's a photo of the Stacy Hotel, and there's... you also have the Intervale Hall, where concerts and that were done. Tell us about that, the Intervale Hall.
Well, that was still around when I was growing up. We'd have concerts. Well, back in the day, they would have dances there, and that was like the center of the community. We'd have like keys there. There would be herring suppers, strawberry festivals, and so forth. And of course, it refers to the concert being there during wartime. So, And I remember having there was something there. There's a photograph at the Beaton Institute of an evening there in 1967. And the place was full. And my brother remembers this. I don't remember. Apparently, one of the beams cracked or something in the building. There was a noise, and everybody was wondering around what it was, but I guess there were so many people there. It was quite an old building at the time, yeah.
Yeah, one thing I get from seeing these pictures in the book, and like, so just when you're looking through all of these places like this, and then there's the photos of the churches. There's like, there's a Baptist church, there's a Methodist church, you have a photo of Zion United. I mean, Gabri's was a really big booming community at one time, right?
Oh, it was, yeah. There were 8 or 9 stores, and it was like a center. Like my father, I think where I grew up were probably about 5 miles away, but they thought nothing of walking down there on a summer evening, right? So even when growing up, you know, let's take a drive down to the village. I mean, how many drives did it take down the village? But you never seem to... You never seemed to tire of that for some reason, because it was, you know, it was an interesting place. It was on a summer evening. I mean, it was a very nice place to go, you know. So, and then of course, you know, back further, you had Gull Cove, and on the south side of Gabri's Bay, and then on the north side, of course, you had the North Shore Road, and I mean, both there's stores in both those places. I mean, Gull Cove, you know, basically disappeared. There's nothing at all, and of course that land along the North Shore was expropriated, which I think someday someone should write a book about that, because it's, you know, it's quite a story where, you know, people had to leave their, you know, move away and got very little money for the land. But
that was for the Fortress Lewisburg, correct?
That's right, yeah. This would be in the mid-60s, yeah. Yeah.
That sounds like a book for you and your brother Don to be working on.
Well, perhaps my brother more so than mine. I'm more of a visual guy, but there's a story there for sure.
Yeah, but visual is right. I mean, just picking these wonderful photos, it's really, I was flabbergasted when I read through the book on the last weekend. And just getting back for the store to a minute, there's this great line from this Horace Gray, who says, he's talking about the stores, and he says the largest one was C.W. Mann's store. He had everything in there from a needle to an anchor. I mean,
yeah,
really. What a great description, right?
That's a great line. I never heard that before, yeah.
Yeah. So who was Horace?
Horace is a former fisherman. I saw him probably about a month ago. He's in the Cove guest home.
Okay.
And he's one of these people that grew up in Gabri's, and then as he says in the book, first fished with his father, and then got his own boat when he was, you know, was quite young. And I think from our conversations that he might, it was common at some, for some fishermen to work on the lake boats on the Great Lakes during the winters, you know?
Yeah.
He might have done that, but I think he spent most of his life in the village, yeah. And, you know, came from a long line of fishermen.
Yeah. Just really fascinating people, and you see as you go through it, names recur like the Hardys and stuff like that, family that lived there. And just briefly tell us a little bit about the Huntington Diaries.
Well, I know, talking to someone from Lewisburg, that he was Melvin Huntington, he was the mayor of Lewisburg, but he also had a store down there, and I can't recall the exact wording, but apparently he had a very distinct way of giving change, the way he counted out the change. So this gentleman I was talking to, Luther, was telling me how he did that. But he seemed quite involved in the church, and with anything going on in Lewisburg. And he, in one of these entries, there was a woman named, her name was Clara Dennis. I think her family might have been involved with the Chronicle Herald at one time. Anyway, she was a photographer, and he showed her around. This would be somewhere in the mid-30s. The photograph of the Mrs. Winton near the beginning of the book.
Yes,
she took that photograph. So he seemed to be the go-to person in Lewisburg. I mean, if any official, any government officials came to town, he would show them around. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a neat entry of Mrs. Huntington's trip to Foreshoe, and she just talks about the weather and what she did.
What he did,
attended a lecture at the Methodist Church. Went to get the mail and all that. But it's just fascinating, all those kind of things. One more thing I'd like you just to tell us a little bit about before we wrap it up is Guyon Island, because you've got a couple of pictures from there. Tell us a little bit about that place.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, you can see, if you're driving today on a clear day from Gabbers to Foreshore, you come over hill there and you can see it to the left in the distance. Mrs. Winton's diary, that was quite a discovery, because it's quite rare, and she was so isolated out there. But it's quite it's about a mile offshore. Opposite on the shore, there's a place called Winging Point, which was quite important for lobster fishing. The lobster fishermen would have shacks there where they stay there. So she remembers, she could see some of the people on the shore from the island. And I found it fascinating that she would record basically the boat traffic.
Yeah.
For want of a better word, ten vessels went east today, five went west, and she would recognize the boat. There was a boat called, called the Dorcas.
The Dorcas, yep.
Yeah, which later sank a couple of years later, but the Dorcas passed by, so she was familiar. And she got quite a few visitors. At one entry, she says, well, we took the cow out. I'm just envisioning how they would get a cow on a rowboat, but...
yeah.
I don't know how that worked, but anyway.
She was the wife of the lighthouse keeper.
Yes, and she died. It's been mentioned by several people that she died tragically in the village in a fire.
Mm.
And another thing about her, my mother wrote a book on Canoe Lake, like in a neighboring village, and the Scottish people at that time were quite interested in charms, like for various ailments and so forth. And my mother describes an incident where the guy was cutting hay in the field with a scythe. And he put the scythe down, but I guess his son didn't notice it and stepped on it and cut himself quite seriously.
Hmm.
And his father, I guess, they refer to this as a charm. He knew several verses of scripture. So he recited the scripture, like looked up to the heavens and recited the verses of scripture. And apparently the bleeding stopped. And my mother continues that he had learned this charm from Mrs. Winton and Gabrus, who was a master of the art. That's how she described it. So,
wow.
Yeah, she was an interesting woman. One woman in Gabrus told me that she remembered her. She lived by herself in Cape Gabrus, which is quite like beyond Gold Cove at one time. And she would see her like heading down there with a bed and with a, I guess she'd come back for to Gabrus for provisions and then heading home along the road, you know.
Yeah, fascinating. Here's one of the entries that really stayed with me. And there's a number of them from May up until March in, you know, decades ago. On February 4th, Mrs. Winton writes, "I killed my old you today. I finished a pair of drawers for Rosie. I baked bread." It's just like, it's life, you know, on Guyan Island. It's just totally fascinating. It's Bill, it's a wonderful book. I think anybody would be interested in this. You do not have to be from Gabrus. I'm telling our listeners, you do not have to be from Gabrus. You don't have to be from Cape Breton nor Nova Scotia to enjoy seeing this book. They're all black and white. They've been curated by Bill, and it's beautifully laid out by Catherine Dimmert. And I just can't say enough. All the photos contributed and found different ways. Where can our listeners get a copy, Bill?
Well, we're still setting up a sales outlet, but for the meantime, it'll be for sale at the Tea and Cookies at the Gabrus Hall for the remaining Saturdays in August. And they can also contact me. I'll give out my phone number.
Okay.
902-884-2277.
Well, that's great, and if anybody needs that again or whatever, they can always get a hold of me, Paul, through the coast. I just want to thank you again. It's a lovely book. I hope you do well with it, and congratulations on it.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.